And that seems to be an obvious direction that we're going in. Maybe yes, maybe no. I mean, it seems that way. The rich people seem to have, or the people with a lot of wealth seem to have an inordinate amount of wealth, whereas the people who are poor, I don't know if they're as poor as they used to be, because poverty, as I was seeing some statistics, has kind of moved up a little bit in standards. It used to be a time when there wasn't a loaf of bread available. But still, by comparison, you know, when you think about it, the wealthy and the poor and the difference and how it makes us feel when we're one or the other. And then comes this other thing, comes this thing that we're going to start talking about, which is what brought this to our attention, which is about inheritance and the inheritance neurosis. I want to talk to this, and I invited to be with me a couple of people, the first of which is Dr. Kent Robert Shaw, my good associate and friend from right here at the DeMille Center and across the street. Kent, welcome back to WBAI, as usual.
Always a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Kent, let's talk about this, just this one particular thing, inheritance neurosis. What a word, huh? We've never defined it. We certainly could wind up putting it in the DSM, because it certainly looks real. What happens when people are waiting? Well, let's talk about waiting for inheritance.
Yeah, I think we all find a lot of people here in New York. They come from a tremendous amount of family money. And we find a lot of people in their teens and 20s and early 30s, they're really not getting their lives very well organized in terms of a big part of our identity and what makes people define themselves, which is their career and their career ambitions. So a lot of people, because they're focused in on the sort of lottery ticket of getting the family inheritance, and maybe something they've thought about since their early childhood, they're really not that motivated. They're not very directional in terms of what to do with their lives and their careers. They're sort of rudderless, and they're sort of waiting around, as macabre as this sounds, for their parents to die. And that's the lottery ticket will then give them a sense of security and perhaps lead to some sense of self-esteem because they'll have money. But they're certainly, at the point we see them, quite unhappy, quite bitter that all this family money is not coming in their direction. And again, quite rudderless, quite unable to know what to do with their days and what to do with their lives other than to think about what will happen if someone they care about dies.
This is Armand DeMille, and this is Kent Robert Shaw. We're talking about, we both, as therapists, and our other guest who is with us, will talk about it as well. We've seen patients who come to us, and they're not happy. And these are people who are the children of the people with the big bucks. And there they are. They're there. And they, as children, they grew up with a lot of focus on materialism, and they were supposed to be special, and they were held separate from the other kids. But, you know, you tend not to get the love and attention and embrace that people who are not so well off might give each other. You know, I mean, more people who are well off live in Connecticut. And, you know, in Connecticut, nobody hugs. Well, I'm only kidding. I always say that. But it's true that you know, if you're one of the wealthy, you look at your children and you could now give your children to somebody else to take care of. You can hire an au pair, and then you could hire an au apple, and you could hire an au anything. You can have somebody take care of your children. Somebody takes them to school. Private tutors take care of them. And this child has no connection with their parent. Now, there's no connection with the parent, and then this one man I saw who came in to see me, who was going to inherit a fortune when his father died, I said, what do you do with your life? And just like you said, Kent, he said, I'm waiting for my father to die. I said, but you like your father. He says, not enough. He says, I'm waiting for him to die. I said, well, what happens when he gets a cold? He says, I hope. He says, my hopes go up when he has a cold. I hope it's going to turn into something. I hope he's going to die. He says, right now my father has me on a budget. He has me on an allowance. He'll only give me a certain amount of money every year. When he dies, I get everything. And I can't wait for him to die. Now, what's it like having struggled up from the bottom to build an empire only to have your children wishing that you would die fast as possible? That's a pretty sorry state of affairs.
Yeah, this situation, I think, only comes about, as you're implying, that that people are feeling this sense of entitlement, right? Because this idea of being, I guess, Paris Hilton being the archetype, you know, somebody who can just, you know, hang out with a small dog and shop and play all day. And why do people have the sense that they don't have to be industrious, productive members of society? So underneath it, there's got to be, I think, with anybody who has this sense that I don't need to work, I don't need to be productive, I should just be taken care of all day as an adult. I should have a lottery ticket. I should be, you know, just come into a family fortune. I shouldn't have to go through the struggles that other people have to make my own money, to work, let's say. And so even though that sense of entitlement, you know, looks like something that people feel, you know, shamed about or feel critical of, underneath that sense of entitlement is often a sense of deprivation. And you really got your finger on the pulse that the deprivation is really an emotional deprivation they feel growing up. And it's true that many of their families, again, to have somebody become very successful is often a time where they're going to have to spend hours and hours a day working, workaholics. I hate to tell the audience that many of the people who are very successful are workaholics. They're not particularly lucky. So we're talking about the children of workaholics.
Going back just a second to this concept, you see, this is where I think we play a very important role. Most people will look at Paris Hilton and think, what a spoiled brat, how negative, how rotten. I mean, I look at Paris Hilton and I almost feel tears when I think about her. When I think of the fact that and I know I hate to even make her more famous because this is what she needs so much. But what I'm seeing is the representation of an illness. I'm seeing her being somebody who never felt complete, who works hard through everything, through videos, through sex, through dressing, through everything. And if you look at her whole family, she comes from this Hilton family, it says there's no love there. And there was no love there. And when you think about other people like Leona Helmsley leaving her money to a dog because she didn't want to leave it to her children because she was angry at them, and you think about what's this like to be in this family? Is it any better than me with my family now? Let's say you're not well off. So if you look at Paris Hilton and you just envy her because she has so many pair of shoes, you know, and so much clothing and just about anything she wants, that's one perception. But to look at her and feel sad and to say, oh my gosh, that poor anomaly, that poor being, that thing over there is much less fortunate, has no love in her life, and probably will never have. It'll be just about impossible, because then comes one of those issues that happen when you have a lot of money and your partner doesn't. And what's it like when you have a lot of money? Who do you attract? Who comes towards you? Who wants to be around you when you're one of those people? To this, I want to introduce my other guest, Tripp Evans. Tripp Evans, Dr. Tripp Evans, is a couples and individual therapist who also works with this issue as well. Tripp, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you. Yeah, great to be here.
Yeah. Now, you've dealt with these cases of couples where the where one person has and the other person doesn't, and give an example of it.
Well, you and Kent bring up some really good points, and before I get to a specific, I just want to also add that I think what's really important here is we're talking about what money means in the relationship and what it means when a child gets the money from the parents, and the issue of attachment and non-attachment. And so the child gets the money, the parent died, the child now has the money, is defined by the money, and what does that mean in terms of that child finding a relationship for him or herself going forward? And when he or she finds somebody, is that person really looking and seeing the person or seeing the money? And so there are a lot of issues here in terms of relationship. And I've got a couple of couples, one in particular that I'd seen a while ago, where he had a very difficult, he had the money, she did not, and he had a very difficult time trusting that she loved him for him. And it was very, very difficult because after he got the money, he was kind of defined by the money.
Well, you know, now that becomes a big issue, doesn't it, Kent? I mean, do you love me? What do you love me for? Do you love me for my power? Do you love me for my money? Do you love me for my body? You know, I guess women who are beautiful feel the same way. What do you love me for? Do you love me for the way I look?
Absolutely. Armand, you and I did a show about 2 or 3 weeks ago talking about beauty and the pitfalls of beauty. And absolutely, this is not Pollyannish and trying to make lemonade out of lemons for people to see that we see routinely the very beautiful women often feeling at a core sense in therapy, would this person like me if I had a scar, or if I gained 15 pounds, or I didn't have these perfect cheekbones? And absolutely, often men, but not always, the same feeling of who I am as a person is not my money. Would this person still love me, my personality, my sense of humor, my warmth, all that? It's one of the reasons I noted that a lot of celebrities really hold on to their childhood friends, because once people are celebrities, everybody wants to get to know them. Everyone's nice to them. They know who are the people from high school and the like who liked them before they were Brad Pitt or...
That's a good point. That's the key to entourage. That's the idea is keep your buds around from childhood, because they at least knew you the whole way. But you bring up this other very important point, Kent, because if you are, you know, some of the people I know who are very fortunate financially, say we have a good FFs as opposed to rich. Rich is just such a poor word. The rich. Poor word, right? No, it's a rich word.
It's an oxymoron.
It's a wealthy word. But the financially fortunate, one of the things about them is that, you know the way you feel when you get into a place of power? You get the feeling that I'm just separate from the rest of the world and I'm different. And you give up being loved. You literally give it up. And I've met so many people who don't even believe that it exists for them. Well, my wife loves me for my money, and I have this money, and my children love me someone. But you give up this concept of a real equal relationship. You know you're being loved for what you do, who you are, and for your money, and that it's a one-way street. And so what happens is you begin to perceive among these people, and I've seen enough of them come through my doors, between either the very famous movie stars or the very wealthy people, when they walk into my office, you see this kind of dead sense about them. They're immune. Nothing could happen. You know, there is nothing. Everybody's going to try to take something from them, and they're immune. You know, I remember I got no locks on my door. That's the way to be. They could steal the rug from the floor, right? Because I'm not going to be somebody who's going to suffer through having people take things from me. But one of the things you have to protect yourself from is that when you have something and there are people who don't have it, they want to take it from you.
Well, that's a really interesting point, because it really goes to what's happening with Britney Spears and the custody battle that she's having with her boys, and that she's really losing, as she implodes, she's really losing a lot of people around her who she had considered her friends growing up. And these are people who are now saying, I'm sorry, I've been subpoenaed, I've got to go to court and talk against you. And to what extent can you trust even your friends once you start imploding?
Wealthism is a set of attitudes directed towards the wealthy. Mind you, it's called wealthism. Wealthism is it's a form of prejudice. It is a form of prejudice. It's like racism. It's different than racism. And it's different than sexism, because wealthism is not created by the people who are doing it, by the people in power. Racism and sexism are usually done by the people in power. The person who is in power is the sexist. The person who is in power is the racist. But wealthism is something that goes in the direction of power. Therefore, it bespeaks something. Therefore, it says, hey, wait a minute, am I judging them too? Do I have a right to judge? Well, sure I do. Look at them. They're rich and they're not even buying lunch for the people down the block. They're rich and they're not spending their money. They won't give it to me. They won't give me a job. So the common symptoms of wealthism are envy, awe, and anger. Now, imagine you have yours, and you know that people have envy, awe, and anger. Have you ever been out to, Beverly Hills? Beverly Hills, California? Beverly Hills is a mile away from south, the worst part of Los Angeles. It's like, they butt up against each other. And the people in Beverly Hills have all this money. They have fortunes. They have the giant houses. And just a mile away are the poorest people in all of Los Angeles. Maybe it's 2 miles away. It amazes me how they feel there. And there, among this wealth, they sit around and they say, you know, with these Hollywood mansions and things like that, they say, oh, yeah, well, we have alarms. We have to have this. We have to protect ourselves. It amazes me how you could not be conscious of why there's about the one day revolution that's going to happen. The one day that everybody's going to get together and say, they got the water up there, let's go get the water. So I think there's an underlying fear that you have, that you live with once you become a person who has, worrying about the people coming after you who have not. And it's another way to live. You know, just imagine if you don't have much, you don't have to worry about people taking it away from you. I guess maybe you always do worry, don't you, though? Even if you have a little, you worry about somebody taking it away from you. There's always somebody who's got less.
But that brings up a really interesting point in terms of the envy, awe, and anger. I'm wondering if there's also an aspect of isolation and narcissism, and that you feel so very much alone. Because
who does? The person.
People
with
who
the
is with the money, who's got the people around him or her. To what extent can they really, and I guess it goes to the lack of trust, too, that this person likes me for me and not for what I can provide or buy for the other person.
Well, you know, it's such an interesting subject, the idea of do I belong? I was talking to one of my friends earlier today, and I was talking about the difference between feeling like I belong and feeling like I don't belong. I have this wonderful, wonderful feeling that I live with, which is that I feel connected to everybody. I feel connected. I mean, there's nothing in between. You could get, maybe I'm fortunate because when I was younger, I lived with the wealthy. When I worked in Wall Street, I saw the people who were at the top of the heap and I spent a little time with them. And then when I was a jazz musician, I spent time with the people who had no money and I grew up in poverty. So having both ranges, people tend not to intimidate me by being one way or the other. But either way, I don't see them as different than me much, just behaviorally. I feel connected to you. You feel connected to me. The reason I could do the magic I do on the radio is because we're connected. We are both in this together. One time I got in the subway and everybody was upset with somebody and I yelled at the top of my lungs. I said, stop. We're all in it together. And everybody stopped and realized, yes, we're all in it together. We're all here on this train together trying to go somewhere. When you're too fortunate or when you're too depressed, when you're too unfortunate, you feel separate from the world. Depressed people feel separated from the world. And the non-depressed, the grandiose, the wealthy, they feel separate from the world. It's such a tendency, and you have to do some work. There's a famous quote by Stephanie Dombra who said, heirs do not have to work. Heirs who do not have to work for a living need to work to have a life. It's a very interesting concept. You know, if you don't have to work for a living, then you have to have some kind of life. What do? Just sit around? We're all in it. They're us. We're them. We're not separate. But when you feel like you're so deprived, you feel separate. There are people who are listening right now who just can't even meet their rent. And they feel like they're alone and they're just going to die and they're just going to curl up in a corner and die. There are people who are old and they feel like, you know, they're going to die of old age because they have nothing, and there are people who are wealthy who just feel like, well, what am I going to do? I'll accumulate more wealth, and then I'm going to die, and then I'll have a legacy. I'll name a street after me. I'll, you know, and you, maybe I'll have my, I'll have 47 hits on my name if you put my name in the internet, you know, maybe that.
Yeah, I think that, again, if we're talking about people who are not motivating and getting their lives towards some productive career or some life goals, I think a lot of those people who are waiting around for their inheritances have the feeling of hopelessness and helplessness that are, is typical of depression, in that they've given up on in any way trying to be their own person to make their own mark in the world, you know. And so a lot of this not pursuing a career, not pursuing any activity, I believe is coming from a sense that they're not able to achieve these goals. They're not able to achieve what they want to achieve in life. And so they're sort of not even trying. They don't want the humiliating disappointment of trying to be a scientist or a therapist or a poet or a writer, because they feel they don't have the juice. They're not that smart. They're not that ambitious. Or shaming word like, I'm too lazy. So that's, it's coming from a dark place in terms of their sense of self-esteem, why they're not trying to pursue their own lives. Because it's true that a lot of children of very successful people are successful themselves. So there has to be something psychologically different between a Paris Hilton and, you know, other people who are able to come from wealth or celebrities and yet have their own person and their own sense of drive and self-esteem and ambition.
You bring up a really good point, Kent, because in order for one to really embrace a career, embrace an occupation, one needs to experiment and have a place where one can fail and fall down. And if you don't have family, if you don't have, if you're waiting for your father to die or your mother to die instead of using them as people who can contain you and be there for you, then to be separate and to find something that's right for you is very, very scary.
You know, very often what a person will do, and I've seen many people do this, is they start learning music. They learn, they give themselves personal challenges. And the interesting thing about doing music, about learning to sing or learning to play piano or learning to play, you know, bass, whatever you do, is the goal is to be good enough to join a group of people who are musicians. Now, that's the far-out goal. You don't just play piano because you want to play for people. You want to be able to be with other musicians. And it's like you're hoping you can earn an entry. You know, you're hoping you can earn that. You're hoping you can earn the place. Well, you can't. You play piano, right?
Yeah, and it's why I'm a doctor today. Because this really gets to the point here.
Yeah,
that certainly I'm somebody at 19 or 20. Sadly, I started listening to Oscar Peterson at about that age. And up until then, I'd been listening to a lot of pianists that were pretty good. But I could, you know, feel I'm able to do sort of what they're doing. And I have to tell you that when I heard Oscar Peterson, it really had this sense of, you know, what is this, for me personally, why am I doing this, you know? Why am I pursuing this? Because there was somebody out there who was playing so well and so beyond my comprehension.
Why are you pursuing your goal as a doctor? Right? Why were you pursuing what? What was the question you asked yourself? Why were you pursuing what? Piano or the doctor?
Piano. At one point, I was stuck between piano and doctor at 18 or 19. And somehow, me listening to Oscar Peterson, unfortunately, made it such that, or, you know, that it was very hard for me to pursue music knowing that I couldn't ever be as good as somebody I was listening to. Was that coming from low self-esteem? Was that coming from a sense that I didn't have the discipline to do that? Or was I even harder for people to admit, I just wasn't that talented? Ouch! You know what I mean? How about healthy humility is that I understand that, you know, there are some geniuses out there, and maybe music I'm good at, maybe science and psychology was my stronger suit. And again, that's where, you know, you hope to have a sense of self-esteem and a sense of self-efficacy in terms of the goals I want to reach, coming to a sense of what am I good at, what do I enjoy doing. Again, a lot of these children of people with wealth they don't have much in terms of self-esteem on any category. I think a lot of them I treat, they say they like to play hard, like Paris Hilton. That's their strong suit. I like to lounge. I like to have fun. I like to do recess all day. And like the banal quote, you know, all play and no work does make you but a toy. Everyone talks about the all work and no play, but the second part of that is it makes you a toy. It makes you not somebody respected too much in our society.
And not respected even by your friends. I mean, except that, you know, they've got. You've got the wealth, or you've got the position, or you've got the contacts. You have to be good to you because you've got to be invited to your party. You know, what if you don't invite me to the party? What if I'm not invited? What if you... And it becomes that whole system, that whole hierarchy that you live in instead, which is this world of narcissism, this world of prestige.
But there's also that very healthy, adaptive sense of narcissism where one can say, I'm not very good at this, I'm going to try something else, as opposed to, I am defined by this, if I leave this, I don't exist. So I think it's important that one is able to have a foundation, and I think family provides that.
One of the things that happened, and I know many of you have been through this, how many of you have ever seen a situation in which somebody dies and somebody leaves something to the family, and then the family separates and breaks up around the inheritance? I recently called somebody who said to me he had a twin brother. And I said, so how's your brothers? Somebody who I knew a long time ago, he says, I don't talk to my brother. And I said, why don't you talk to your brother? He said, we had a fight over my father's will. Now, get this. You think this was weird? He's married to the sister of the other person, and they don't talk to each other. And so two brothers and two sisters don't talk to each other over an argument over the death of somebody, and it was about a will. And you know what they were fighting about? A hat collection. It was a collection of hats. One person wanted it, the other person wanted it. What was it really about? What we, who are in the mental health profession, know is that people argue about symbolic things when they can't really face the reality of the death itself, and they can't deal with the feelings, and they don't want to deal with the feelings, and they don't want to deal with the loss, so they wind up fighting over trivia. But how many families out there right now, people listening now, had breakups over things like who got the name on the house, who was entitled to the house in New Jersey, you know, who did they leave it to, who did my mother leave it to, you know, Leona Helmsley, I'll leave it to the dog, and what it does to you. I never inherited anything, and I actually did. When my mother died, nobody knows this, her union sent me $50 a month for 8 years. And a $50 check every month for 8 years did not mean an awful lot of money, but it kept her kind of alive every time that check came. And a funny thing happened. When it ran out, I grieved for my mother in a different kind of way. It was almost like this was the attachment. This was the thing that was keeping me going. I ran into a guy recently who said the kids are fighting over their mother's death. Mother died suddenly. They're fighting over her clothing because they all want to wear her clothing. He said, what do you think of that idea? And I said, wait a minute. Maybe they should grieve instead. Maybe they should deal with the fact that she's really gone. We're going to talk about this more when I come back. We're going to take a short break. And when I come back, I'm bringing you a gift. Now, dear friends, some of you don't like jazz. Those of you who don't like jazz, I fully understand you may want to turn this down. But I found something in the archives. I found Bill Barron, who was my next-door neighbor for a number of years when I was a kid. And I used to hear Bill all the time, tenor saxophone, on 6th Street between 2nd and 3rd Avenue. Bill Barron played tenor, and he never became famous or anything like that. Bill Barron, brother of Kenny Barron, who became very famous, played piano, and Booker Irvin. Booker Irvin, great tenor saxophonist. Booker Irvin died at some point, and I wound up adopting his son, Booker Jr. So here are these two people, and I found music where the two of them are together. So you're going to hear what's called a tenor battle. And that's where they are doing trading fours. And you're going to hear two different tenors, one who has a more of a soul and the other one who's a little more of a mind. You could barely tell the difference. Fabulous, fabulous piece of music. 4 minutes. If you hate jazz, it's going to be fast jazz. If you hate it, turn it off and come back after the break. I inherited this music. What a beautiful thing. We'll be back with you very shortly. I want to remind you, those are two separate instruments, trading fours. I would love to keep going. This is a someday, maybe during the fun drive, I'm going to play this entire thing for you. What a find. So I looked it up on the internet to try to find it, and it did exist, Bill Barron, and they did make this recording, but it's totally non-existent. You can't get it. It's nowhere to be found. What a pity. But I do have the tape. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. Talking about inheriting, I inherited quite a bit of music. You know, it would be nice to pass on music. What happens if you are somebody and you're coming into money and you're preparing your children for an inheritance? What do you need to do? First of all, you got to figure about your own issues of money. What is money to you? Is money love? Right? I know a woman who goes out with a man. She goes out with men. And the minute she goes out with men, she says, I would like you to buy me something. She says, I like men to buy me things. And so you'll buy her, and you'll say, what? And she'll pick a dress or something and say, buy me this dress. And he buys her the dress, and she stays with him. And the next time she sees with him, she says, what are you going to buy me today? And he says, why don't I give you some money? No, 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 you have to buy me something. And so he'll take her to a shop, and she'll buy a pair of boots. Now, this is a true story. I know this woman. She's a client. And she says, I'm the only way I can be with a man is if he buys me something. That's the only way that I know he loves me. See, now that's very interesting. That's why they give you Valentine's Day. And that's why they tell you to buy presents at Christmas. Because supposedly we don't know how to love each other. We just know it through money, through gifts. What is money to you? Is money your safety? Does money your security? Is money your love? Is money your salvation? Is that what it's going to be? Are you waiting for it to happen? How many people have we studied who have won the lottery, and they win the lottery, and you go study their lives a little while after they won the lottery, and they're in worse shape they were before they won the lottery. They're in much worse shape. How did that happen? People after 9/11 who inherited a great deal of money, who got money from the mutual funds who were up there and, you know, who were giving out money, $1 million to everybody in the family, they're not better off. Even though they lost somebody, still the money hurts in many ways. What is money to you? What is it? That's what I asked myself when I worked in Wall Street. I was making money. I was making so much money. A Lower East Side slum kid was suddenly making gobs of money at a young age. And I said, what's this all about? I don't feel anything except richer. And so I gave it up. I left. I said, I'll go to school. I'll go become something. So when you have children and when your children are young, you try to learn and avoid enabling your children. And enabling your children is in a way to reinforce their belief that they are very special and that they don't have to do things. You show your children that you love them by spending time with them, not by buying them presents. It's not the gifts. I know this wonderful mother who, when her children come running to her every time that they see a new present somewhere else, she says, no, you can't have it. And they say, why can't we have it? Well, she's got the money to buy it, but she says, no, I love you. You know, and she gives them love every time. And these kids don't suffer from not getting the new Xbox toy or whatever it is. Don't try to protect your children from the rawness of life. The difficulty is the cushion. If you give them too much of a cushion, children are going to suffer. There is a mistake with having rubberized playgrounds. You know, rubberized playgrounds. The disadvantage of having rubber underneath the what do they call those, the monkey posts?
Monkey bars,
right thing under the monkey bar. Now they have rubber underneath it, so if you fall down, you don't break anything. Well, it's a disadvantage to that, because you should learn that if you climb and you fall, you do break something. And that's okay. You'll get through life. Learn that when you fall down, it could hurt you. Learn it, you know? So try not to protect your children from the rawness of life. Try not to give them a limousine that brings them to school. Let them walk there if they have to walk there. Let them find a way to deal with the kids in the school. Try not to protect them every time somebody bullies them. You know, you could fight for them a little bit, but you got to let them, allow them to be somewhere in life. You encourage your children to develop competence and confidence that comes from learning how to do things for themselves. And it's the idea of, you do it, I can't, you take over. Mommy, how do I get this? Figure it out. Figure it out. You'll get there. Figure it out. Encourage them to do things for themselves. Self. Start teaching them the value of work early. Give your children chores. Give them things to do. And let them see what it's like to work. And when teaching your children, always strive for balance. And you want to teach them that there's a balance between what they do and who they are. And it's not just how they perform that they get love for. And the best way to teach healthy values is to model them for your children. To model them. To remember, every time you take the easy way out in front of your child, you're teaching your child take the easy way out. Just a few more. You know, you could help your children learn how to handle money responsibly. It's like if they don't see money as anything but a coupon, and I know children who see money as they have limitless money. They could buy whatever they want whenever they want to buy it. And I see that. How do they get a chance to understand that money is a barter exchange and it's got value? When you talk about money, about children, be positive. Avoid warning messages. Don't warn them. Try to talk about money and talk about it as a positive, but not as something that they have to be too careful about and watch out for. Don't attach paranoia to money. And tell your children about the good things that you do with your money, that your family has achieved with their money. And lastly, teach your children to share their wealth, to share it in some way, and start early with their sharing it, you know? Now, this is a way to wind up maybe saving your children from going through some of the Paris Hilton syndrome. I guess we could call it the Paris Hilton syndrome, couldn't we? It's quite a thing. Imagine, she did become famous for something, you know?
Notorious, perhaps.
Yeah, notorious. Well, you know, but it's as notorious, it's still sad. It's as pathetic to me as any other human.
Yeah, I think, again, under her life is just a lack of goals, a lack of values. There just doesn't seem to be a real center of somebody who, you know, has something that they're looking forward to, something they feel like they're going to be able to achieve and make their mark in the world. And, you know, it seems like that's what she's known as, just a playgirl, as it were, you know, someone who just gets to play all the time, as an adult and is taken care of.
And it gets to be a place where you get trapped. This is Armand DeMille with you. It's a positive mind. We're talking about the differences between wealth and non-wealth. We're talking about the perception of the wealthy as all bad. They are not. I know some people who are very good people, who do very good things, who are well fixed. And some people use wealth to create a better world. And the truth of it is, if you want to know which ones they are, they're the ones you don't know about. The ones who don't do it for fame, for reputation, you know? The ones who aren't getting all of the accolades for what they did. Those are not the ones that are so important. The ones who are really important are the ones you don't hear about. Because they do things for this world, and I know many who do. I know many who are active in some of the places where I've been politically active, where they have limitless giving. I know a man who takes every penny he ever earned and transferred it to a political thing he believed in, and it just filled his heart tremendously. You know, he used to get paid a salary, and he got paid tips. Whenever he got his cash automatically went to what he was believing in, you know, just automatic. So if we're feeling powerless and we're feeling bad, you know, there is a way to perceive those that have from where we are, that those that don't have, and understand that on some level, if you're not fortunate, you're being envied. That there's a part of you that has an ease of loving that they'll never have. You know, you can be loved for who you are. You can be seen for who you are. You can be appreciated for who you are. When you're too well fixed, that's virtually impossible.
Yeah, I have certainly seen people who, as they grow up and their parents, let's say, lose some of their money, then the worst nightmare of many parents, which is the only reason you call, the only reason you see me, the only reason you come around for Yom Kippur or Thanksgiving or Christmas, is because you want something from me, you know? And so they're feeling that they're not loved as parents, but they're loved because there's going to be a gift attached, or they're just constantly have to stay in the good graces because of some future inheritance. So I've seen many, as we were talking about people dating people, feeling like, do you love me for me? Well, many a parent, I think, has the same worry. Do my children really love me? And I think when you don't have very much, when your family's calling you and seeing you over the holidays, at least you know it's out of love.
And what I've experienced, too, especially with some of the couples that I've worked with, there's this one gentleman whose grandfather has all the money. And unfortunately, he's got a father who calls him and says, you need to do something to get this money from your grandfather because he's not listening to me, which makes it very difficult because in this case, my patient who wants to get away from the money and create a life for himself, because he does have a job, he's the only one who is working, that it makes it very difficult for him because he's getting a mixed message here. It's saying, no, stay enmeshed, stay with us, work for the money that's part of the family, as opposed to working for yourself.
Yeah, I think that, you know, this whole idea about people connecting, being with people because there's something in it for them, you know, is really talking about choosing relationships based on what you can do for me, you know, which is, again, a sort of narcissistic way to choose who you want to be with. And again, many of the children we're talking about of these very wealthy people, the reason how these people became very wealthy is their tremendous work ethic and workaholism. But also these are people that spent many evenings surrounded by people based on who they can do business with, who they can work deals with, and they get a communication. Again, the next door neighbor who's a psychiatrist or a therapist, why would we want to hang out with him or her? You know, you need to socialize with people, not because of shared interest or shared compatibility, but there always has to be some deal, some business deal going on underneath. And again, a very sad way that money becomes a motivating force for much of people's lives.
What can I get from somebody versus how can I connect to somebody?
Right. Our guests are Trip Evans, Dr. Trip Evans, and Dr. Kent Robert Shore, also known as Shaw, also known as Trip and Kent. I like that. Hey, 212-209-2900. We got time for one or two telephone calls. 212-209-2900. Have you ever been through the inheritance conundrum? That thing that happens? I'm sure you have. I'm sure the phones would be lit up like crazy. We only have a few minutes, but 212-209-2900. I want to hear from you as well. Tomorrow, Roberta Atti and I will be back on radio talking further about memory. I hope she remembered to be here. Oh, she'll remember, right? This is a joke, because she's got to remember to be here. We're going to be talking about memory a little further and some of memory and love, how memory affects love. It's kind of an interesting thing. Wait till you hear about this tomorrow. But 212-209-2900, let me take your calls. Hi, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille.
Hello.
Hello there.
Can you hear me all right?
Yes, can you talk a little louder, please?
Yes, I apologize. Is this better?
Yes, much better.
Yes, I have one of my very good friends. I live up in Briarcliff Manor. One of my very good friends had received a great inheritance. I think we were both around the age of approximately 14. Hello?
Yes, I'm here.
Yes. He received a large inheritance from this grant.
Kent, there's some, yeah, Michael, there's a lot of studio noise, too. And the call's not there. I wonder what happened to that man. He's from Briarcliff Manor. And see, they don't get any better service than we do. 212-209-2900. Sorry we didn't get that call. Let's take another one. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, hi.
Mike, Michael, I think your mic is open in the studio because I'm hearing the...
Yeah, hi, Michael.
All right, hi there, you're there. Hello. Oh, boy.
Hi there, you're there. Hello.
I think we're having a little trouble with making this connection happen. Hi there, you have your radio on?
Yeah, hi. No, I turned my radio down.
Now your radio's all the way off. Good. Hi there.
Hi.
Now, what were you saying?
Well, I wanted to relate that question in terms of certain communities and the influence that has. I haven't heard anybody talk about that in terms of certain communities or get built up from that particular inference versus other communities.
Well, what do you mean? Talk to me about...
In terms of, let's talk about the black community or
sure.
the Asian community or the Indian community in terms of if you don't have, personally, if you don't have this influence to give somebody, then it's almost like they move away from it. So that leaves that particular community always struggling to build that kind of influence, if you understand what I'm saying.
Influence meaning?
Meaning in terms of the wealth.
The wealth. In other words, you want to be able to... can you give me an example
Let
of
me
that?
Give you an example.
Give me a personal example.
I live in Westchester County, and I know quite a few doctors in Westchester community that live in my community, but living in my community as a doctor versus living in another community as a doctor, as a white person versus a black person, it's the influence is so far and few because you don't get that connected influence on one side versus the other.
And so what happens as a result of it?
Well, the community doesn't get to build up. You don't have that kind of so-called disconnect from...
I hear you. Yes, you don't have that kind of disconnection. Recently, I was in Fort Howard in Brooklyn.
Huh?
And it was Fort Greene. It was in Fort Greene, Brooklyn. And that way, I always knew that as an all-black neighborhood, and I went in there, it was Fort Greene. And it was just, you know, everybody was getting along with everybody. And somebody told me recently they got off a stop in Harlem, and they saw mostly white people walking around Harlem. So there are places where people have kind of done it, and then there are places where the separateness is such that it's still a hard battle. And are you talking about that kind of a battle?
Yes, absolutely.
And has it hurt you personally?
It doesn't really hurt me, but it needs to be addressed in terms of on either side. You know,
how?
You see,
how can we address it? What do you think
you
we can do?
You talk about it. You talk about
like
the reality
of... Like we're talking about it now.
Yes, you put it out there so it's not, you know, the gentleman was talking about, you know, this one knows this one because of who he is, and he gets
That's
to
right.
choose... what he wants to do, whether it affects him positively or negatively, he gets to choose. Certain
and so
places,
it's got to be out there somewhere. I absolutely agree with you. And it's programs like this that maybe will wake a few people up to say, hey, we've got to take care of everybody, including ourselves.
Thank you.
You know?
You're doing a wonderful job, Armand.
Thank you.
I have to tell you, you're doing a very good job. But you need to be able to... Not only you, but the community as a whole and BAI needs to begin to open up a dialogue in terms of what is really happening. You talk about rich and poor in the community as a whole.
Sure, and it's much better than just pointing a finger and saying those are the bad ones and those are the good ones and this is the way it is. It's opening up the dialogue that makes a difference. I really appreciate your call. Thanks for calling in.
Bye.
Bye-bye. And this is Armand DeMille. Yes, there was a recent building I saw. It was built on 78th Street and 3rd Avenue. And it had a sign on it. A sign that said, privileged living for the privileged few. And this was an apartment building. And I just couldn't believe that they could put that sign up there. For the privileged few. I'm surprised it's still standing. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We have to be going again. Dr. Trip Evans, Dr. Kent Robert Shaw, my special guest. Thank you for being here, my friends. We're going to go back to, we're going to just stick Michael with this wonderful music and he'll have to just decide what to do. And I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. Bye-bye for now. And here you are. Here's a little something new.